for Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And got a ton of news for you and three good interviews lined up. Well, I don't know if they're good yet, but hopefully they will be. First up in the news, Der Spiegel. No, actually, not first up. That's second up. First up, massacre yesterday in Iraq. 262 Iraqis killed in truck bombings across Iraq. 262. So that's, if you remember the Oklahoma bombing, remember how tragic that was? Another 100 more people than that. Yeah, Iraqis are people. You knew that, right? Okay. And six Americans also killed, I think, five of them in a helicopter crash. But the surge is working. You know, the poll came out yesterday. It was cited all over TV. Well, Americans are apparently willing to give the surge a chance. They say that the surge is working. What is it with people? What is it with... Is it you guys? Well, TV keeps telling me the surge is working, but that no one will say that over and over and over again. So it must be true. And on top of that, not only is the surge working, but the damn liberal media won't say that. Is this based on any facts? That America has surrendered to the Sunni insurgency and decided it's okay if they're an insurgency as long as they fight the tiny percentage of them that are foreign fighters up to this point? As we're taking one step forward and two steps back, as William S. Lynn says, arming the Sunni side. In the Civil War now, too? That's the surge is working and the American people are understanding, oh, the surge is working. TV said 10 times in the last couple of weeks, I heard. Oh, and the radio, too. The radio was certain. The surge is going great. And even those liberal warmongers from the Brookings Institution say it's working. So if they say it's working, then it's working. How can it possibly be that grown-ups are buying this crap? You know, you can fool a 3 or 4 or 5 year old into believing in the Easter Bunny or what have you, but this is ridiculous. I don't know where they're getting this. The surge is working. Yeah, this just in, 262 Iraqis killed yesterday. And the surge is going great at the same time. There's double think for you. Yeah, both of those things are true. That's right. And Justin Raimondo has a great article about this today on antiwar.com. Decline and Fall is the name of his piece. Article in the Financial Times, the Comptroller General of the United States warning that the Iraq War could bring down the United States. Learn from the fall of Rome, U.S. warned, is the headline in the Financial Times. The U.S. government is on a burning platform of unsustainable policies and practices with fiscal deficits, chronic health care underfunding, immigration, overseas military commitments, threatening a crisis if action is not taken soon, the country's top government inspector has warned. David Walker, Comptroller General of the U.S., issued the unusually downbeat assessment of his country's future in a report that lays out what he calls chilling long-term simulations. These include dramatic tax rises, slashed government services, and the large-scale dumping by foreign governments of holdings of U.S. debt. Drawing parallels with the end of the Roman Empire, Mr. Walker warned that there were striking similarities between America's current situation and the factors that brought down Rome, including declining moral values and political civility at home, an overconfident and overextended military in foreign lands, and fiscal irresponsibility by the central government. Sound familiar? Mr. Walker said. In my view, it's time to learn from history and take steps to ensure that the American Republic is the first to stand the test of time. Mr. Walker's views carry weight because he is a nonpartisan figure in charge of the Government Accountability Office, often described as the investigative arm of the U.S. Congress. In an interview with the Financial Times, Mr. Walker said he had mentioned some of these issues, but now wanted to turn up the volume. Some of them were too sensitive for others in government to have their names associated with. Okay, well, there you have it, folks. The Comptroller General of the United States is now where I was when I was 16 years old, a sophomore in high school. Before I could even drive my car, I used to not believe in blind spots. I have blind spots. Shit, I'm 16. I know everything. I don't even have blind spots because that's for people who can't see good or something. That's who I was when I knew that America was headed down the path of the Romans, that our republic was not going to survive because we were turning it into an empire and it was going to destroy itself. And that if we wanted to have our society last, we would have to slash the size of government by, say, about 70%, bring our troops home and make peace with the rest of the world. Abandon our empire and embrace our Bill of Rights, and that if we didn't do it soon, we were going to be completely screwed. So congratulations, Mr. Comptroller. I should be happy, right? But what is it? 2007? This is the first bureaucrat in the entire U.S. government who's willing to say, hey, can we just stop and take a breath for 1 second before we drive this entire society off a cliff? To his fellow bureaucrats, welcome to reality. You can either have a republic or an empire. You cannot have it both ways. You can have your Bill of Rights, or you can own little brown people in the Middle East and their resources. It's one or the other. And our limited constitutional republic that could last another 500-something years, or who knows what, till the aliens come and kill us all, is instead being driven straight off the edge of a cliff at top speed. And of course, he nails it exactly. Declining moral values and political civility at home, an overconfident and overextended military in foreign lands, and fiscal irresponsibility by the central government. Fiscal irresponsibility by the central government. That means they're spending $3 trillion a year. One of those trillions just on subjugating foreigners. That might be the fiscal irresponsibility that Mr. Walker is referring to. So, okay, there you go. Welcome to the reality as I understood it in 10th grade. Republic good, empire bad. Republic can last a long time, empires fall. Bill of Rights good, foreign occupation bad. Elections good, coup d'etat bad. Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Comptroller General, for bringing the plainly obvious to our eyes. And you know what's funny, though, is there are still people, America's not an empire. How could you say America's an empire? Well, only because of our political and economic and military dominance over every country and every continent on Earth, except Russia and China, basically. And we certainly have economic dominance in China. Maybe it's the 1,000 military bases in 170-something countries around the world. Maybe it's the state of permanent war that's been waged since Theodore Roosevelt was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy. That might have something to do with it. The permanent state of war in other people's countries. Great show lined up for you today. Charlie Savage from the Boston Globe will be on to talk about the national government, the Homeland Security state, setting up cameras all over your neighborhood. Mikey Weinstein will be on to discuss the indoctrination and brainwashing by the craziest brand of post-millennialist, dispensationalists, rapturist Christians of young men in the military. Being the captive audience brainwashed by these kooks. And Stu Bykofsky will be here to tell us why he thinks America ought to suffer another 9/11 attack. It's the only thing that will unite us. It's Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and introducing our first guest today. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Boston Globe and the author of Takeover, the return of the imperial presidency and the subversion of American democracy. Charlie Savage, welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Good to talk to you. And, fair to say you about scared the hell out of me with this article you wrote last week here. Or was it Monday? I'm sorry, I forget.
Came out
August
on 12th,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, the article is U.S. doles out millions for street cameras. And now this is the kind of thing, we've been seeing cameras go up, at least here in Austin, Texas, for 10 or 12 years, I guess. But this article is about how these cameras are going up even in the tiniest of little towns and not, you know, places like Times Square, but in the neighborhoods in big cities, and that the national government, through the Department of Homeland Security and its grants, are paying for most of this. Is that right?
Yeah, no, what's interesting about this is the Department of Homeland Security has a number of different grant programs in which it helps states and cities try to fight terrorism in various ways. And they've doled out $23 billion since 2003 in these grants. And they've gone to all kinds of different things. They've bought radios that help cops talk to firefighters, which was a problem on 9/11. They've paid for emergency drills. But one of the things that they've been doing is funding through these grants the ability of both big cities and small towns to buy surveillance cameras for city streets and parks and stuff that are all linked up and can store digital video image potentially forever, this sort of new digital high-tech surveillance cameras as opposed to the old-fashioned analog grainy stored on a video cassette kind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fundamentally different than these other kinds of things. It's one thing to improve a radio or build a better fence. And it's another thing to install cameras where there weren't cameras before. And what's interesting is that when you ask them, well, how much of this $23 billion has gone to the cameras specifically, they won't tell you. They just won't say. But if you do a search through newspapers, small-town newspapers, large newspapers, and databases, and also press releases from local congressmen who brag about, federal pork dollars being spot to their district, it becomes apparent that this is going on everywhere, everywhere. Just in the last month, just since July, in St. Paul, Minnesota, in Madison, Wisconsin, in Pittsburgh, all of them putting together million-dollar grants to add 60 to 80 cameras, and little towns like Liberty, Kansas, population 95, is putting a camera from the Homeland Security Department in its park. In Scottsbluff, Nebraska, population 14,000, using a $180,000 grant from the Homeland Security Department to put cameras throughout its few streets. And in all of these cases, what's happening is the local city government, they might not have bought this without the fact that it was free. It was on the table. And so they said, sure, why not? And so it's rapidly accelerating the spread of this technology, and yet we can't know exactly how much taxpayer dollars are going to this because the department won't say.
You say in your article that your best estimate by going through all those papers is tens, probably hundreds of millions of dollars worth of these cameras.
Probably, because the examples I decided to you were ranged from a few thousand dollars in the case of that one camera for the tiny town to maybe $3 million for Pittsburgh. But then when you add in places like New York City, which has gotten, $15 million just for this purpose, and other big cities that have been doing this going back to 2003, it's got to be way up there. But what is it? They won't say.
And now you quote at the end of your article Joseph Lieberman talking about how we need a national strategy. Is that a recent quote, or that's from before all this began with the Homeland Security Department?
Well, this has been going on since 2003 with the Homeland Security Department. Lieberman has proposed an amendment just in the last, month, that would try to say, well, let's get some sense around what exactly we're doing here so that, on the one hand, to the extent we are setting these cameras up, that they all work together and are being used efficiently, but B, also, we ought to have some rules about what can be done with this data at the same time, because right now we're operating in kind of a Wild West atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually something that unfortunately was cut by the copy desk for space reasons at the bottom of the article. Was, we aren't the first to do this. London is really the pioneer of having blanket surveillance coverage on public spaces. They did this before anyone else. They've got more cameras than anyone else.
They have millions, actually.
Yeah, and they've linked in both government paid for cameras and private cameras, like the bank, you know, has a camera on the corner and they can feed that data into the government data banks as well.
Well, and that's a very important point right there. You talk about in your article that New York, Baltimore, and Chicago are all working on projects to link up the private cameras to the public ones. And see, my thing has always been, I don't really mind if I'm being surveilled by a camera on private property at the local gas station or whatever. They got to do whatever they got to do for security, and I don't have to go in there and what have you. But that's different than having a government camera. But now they want to link up all the gas station cameras to the same database?
Well, this is, I mean, what I was getting at was, yes, they do, which of course would dramatically expand the scope of this. But in England, what they have that we don't have here is they have an extremely detailed set of regulations about what can be done with these this kind of surveillance data. For example, laws saying at what point does it have to be erased, as if so you don't just start accumulating years and years that you could go back and search through using computer programs to find out, you know, so that what was happening 4 years ago on such a street corner, or you can't retrace someone's steps back in time beyond a limit. They have requirements for signs that say, hey, you're under surveillance on this corner. They have requirements about who can transfer the data, who can't, what can be used for cameras. You have to apply for permits, essentially, and say what you're going to use the camera for, and you can't go beyond that. Very regulated set of controls to keep it from becoming you know, just getting out of control and becoming sort of a tool of repression, even though they've got so many cameras. In the United States, we don't have any laws like that. It's a totally unregulated vacuum environment.
Yeah.
And so part of, I think, what Lieberman is getting at with this calling is we ought to sit down and think about it, because to the extent that this is inevitable, just because once the technology is there, we're going to use it, and to the extent that it's getting here a lot faster because the Homeland Security Department is essentially handing free millions of dollars to anyone who's willing to put it up in town X, we better get some rules in place so that a few years from now we don't wake up and find ourselves in a very sort of unfortunate situation.
Yeah, forgive me if I don't sound too reassured. Lieberman, he's calling for a national strategy for helping to promote what's already going on. The national government's the one pushing all this. As you say, free money to any locality that wants to spend it on cameras, here you go. And now he's going to be the same one to protect me. It's the same thing as all their laws about, you know, how all the different numbers they assign me can be used or abused. You know, they're the ones who give me the numbers. In fact, I just got a letter in the mail last week said, oh, by the way, all your information has been stolen from us, this company you've never heard of and never done any business with. And sorry about that. You might want to go ahead and change all your bank accounts and what have you. And all my information, what is it that they got? They got my social security and my driver's license number. That's how they can access all my stuff. And I don't know, it's just, that's what bothers me, is it's the fox guarding the hen house. You know, Joe Lieberman, the guy enslaving me, is going to write the rules to make sure it isn't so bad.
Well, I mean, I just don't know if I agree with that. At least he's talking about it, and no one else is talking about it. And so this is going to happen whether or not Lieberman's amendment passes. If it passes, at least there'll be some requirement that people are looking at what rules ought to be in place instead of just sort of having the cameras go up everywhere. And then it's just a fait accompli.
Yeah.
And the other thing, what you're getting at is, you know, we're entering sort of a brave new world of electronic data privacy issues that just didn't exist before. And it's not just the government driving it. Private companies are still collecting data on every step we take, every credit card transaction, every ATM withdrawal, every time we pass through an Easy Pass toll booth. You know, this is all, or subway system now, this is all being recorded. And these databases can all be combined and are going to be combined. And when you get to cameras as well, there's a whole bunch of, you know, these technologies used to be limited by the fact that you had to have someone looking at the monitor for it to do any good. Otherwise, it was just a camera recording nothing. You know, mm-hmm. A tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it. But with the advent of digital instead of analog, which means it's a lot more detailed and it's easy to store it forever on a hard drive, and the advent of some technologies that are right now primitive but are rapidly improving, in part with help from government grants, but are going to improve regardless, such as face recognition technology, license plate readers, software that analyzes what's considered to be, quote, anomalous behavior, weird expressions, odd footfall patterns. It's going to become very easy to attract the attention of the authorities as here's someone that stands out and ought to be scrutinized. And it's going to be very easy for those whoever has access to that data, those authorities, to not just look at what you're doing now, but to go back and look at everything you've ever done, because the data can get stored perpetually. Just retrace your steps back in time, use face recognition technology to hunt through and find you. That's not there today. This is a little bit science fiction, but it's going to be here maybe 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
This is the idea of we ought to have rules in place now that some people, including conservatives, are saying, and that's, I think, what Lieberman's amendment is partially aimed at.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, Bob Barr called it, he compared it to the Panopticon, the prison setup, where you may or may not be being watched at any given time, but you don't. There's no way for you to know. So you basically assume or behave as though you're being monitored at all times. And you point out in your article how this can have a real chilling effect. In fact, I know even as a teenager going to political protests, and then the state troopers would pull up and start taking everybody's pictures. And in my imagination, I just figure, well, there it goes. It's in my file for the rest of my life now that I'm here protesting whatever it is I'm protesting. And that's the kind of thing that I'm sure would discourage a lot of people from ever even showing up in the first place.
Well, that is the articulated worry. How does it change things if not only is there no longer anonymity in public, the sense that you're at the rally, you're walking down the street, you're walking into the doctor's office, you're cheating on your wife, even, you know, which is not illegal, even if it's immoral. But now you can't do that anymore without there being a record of it that's traceable to your name, that can, even if not discovered today, can be discovered tomorrow if someone, you know, keyword searches for it, essentially. How does that change how people live their lives? You know, this is the new world that we're headed towards. We're not there yet, but we're getting there, and now we're getting there a lot faster. And so, it's something that we ought to think about.
Have you ever seen that movie Demolition Man, where Sylvester Stallone chases Wesley Snipes into the future and all that?
I have, a long time ago.
Yeah, there's a scene in there where Sandra Bullock is the cop, and they're looking at the little monitor screen, and Sylvester Stallone says, "Come on, let's go get him." And she says, "Well, he doesn't have a chip in his hand. How are we supposed to get him?" And he says, "Well, we go look for him." And, you know, the cops were just used to the idea that that's how you find somebody, is you look on the monitor and see where the tracking device in their hand tells you they are. And they couldn't even imagine the idea of a cop actually having to go out and drive his car around looking for the bad guy. And that's the thing that gets me, is everybody getting really, really used to this brave new world as it is built up around us. In your article, I was absolutely astounded to see 71% to 25% say that this is just perfectly fine.
Definitely broad support for this. Now, and you can't go overboard, right? Because there's no doubt that there is some utility to cameras. We've seen it in several times recently in England, where there was an attempted terrorist attack that failed, or in some case, whoever the perpetrators were, you know, survived. And the surveillance data was useful in figuring out who those guys were and taking them down, as well as their networks, before they could try again. And so that's why this gets complicated, right? You can't just say we're not going to have cameras, we're not going to use this technology which has utility, but you better have rules in place and not to make sure that it's only used for good purposes and not bad.
Sure, yeah, that's fair. And you know, personally, I would be less alarmed, I guess, if it was just the state of Texas. But when it's the Department of Homeland Security, which to me is something that I'm pretty sure is unconstitutional and shouldn't exist in the first place, pushing all this stuff, it seems, you know, really unconstitutional, making all the local enforcement agencies, the 18,000 different enforcement agencies across this country, every day becoming more and more dependent on the central government for their authority and their ability to carry out their authority.
I don't necessarily agree with your legal analysis about what's constitutional or not. I think it's more of a policy issue that needs to be debated. But I hear you.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time today, everybody. Charlie Savage from the Boston Globe. And someday I'm going to have to get this book and interview you about Takeover, the Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. I know you wrote some prize-winning articles about the president's signing statements and so forth. I'd like to interview you about all that someday if I could.
All right. I sure appreciate it. That book is out next month, and so we'll we'll see whether it's of interest to anyone.
All right, cool. I can't wait to read it. Thanks very much, Charlie Savage from the Boston Globe, everybody.
Thank you.
All right, this is Anti-War Radio, and we will be right back after this. Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and I have here this article from Der Spiegel. Liberals on the warpath. Democrats are seeking to position themselves as being more hawkish than the Republicans. And Congress has just approved the biggest military budget ever. Newt Gingrich was more than satisfied. The Archbishop of Americans Conservatives was purring like a cat when he appeared at a luncheon with foreign journalists. Better yet, a cat that had just devoured a couple of mice. Gingrich's mice are Democrats who have recently begun challenging wartime President George W. Bush by trying to beat him at his own game. Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama has just raised the issue of terror cells in Pakistan and suggested the idea of a U.S. military attack on the nuclear state. "If Musharraf won't act, we will," he told an audience at Washington's Wilson Center. With that kind of rhetoric, the Democrats' new shining hope might as well be called Barack Bush Obama. Yeah, that was really a good one there. A man like Gingrich, who has conveniently replaced the now defunct image of the Soviet communist as his public enemy number one with that of the Islamic fanatic, should feel vindicated, in fact even praised, patronizingly of course, the young senator saying that what Obama had to say about Pakistan was spot on. Gingrich is pleased to see a political adversary calling for a new military campaign when everyone else these days is talking about withdrawal. Pakistan, said Gingrich, quote, is enormously dangerous. We need to have a strategy for Pakistan. Of course, when someone like Gingrich talks strategy, he really means the use of missiles, mortars, and flamethrowers. The winds have shifted in Washington. America, not just its president, is at war. The Democrats are still critical of the failed Iraq campaign, but they're no longer opposed to the war on terror in general, never have been. It has been accepted, and not just as a metaphor. Opinion polls have shown consistently for months that while most Americans disapprove of Bush, very few are opposed to the worldwide fight against terrorism. Most Americans believe that the campaign against Al-Qaeda and its ilk is the only conceivable, in fact, the natural reaction against the attacks of September 11, 2001. The president is not faulted for his declaration of war against the terrorists, but he is blamed for having botched the war in Iraq. 92% of Americans are opposed to an immediate withdrawal. No, is that real? Oh, my God. And a majority don't want to see... No, that's not right. It was a third that was for withdrawing all the troops as soon as possible just the other day. I just read the other day. That's not right. And another third that wanted at least a partial withdrawal. It was only one third that wanted to stay. Yeah, but anyway, so, well, what the hell? I'm not going to sit here and read through this whole article. It's on the front page of antiwar.com, Der Spiegel, the German paper. All about the Democrats, Obama and Hillary and Edwards, and how all of them are a bunch of bloodthirsty, warmongering savages who want to bomb Iran, who want to bomb Pakistan. Anybody who thinks the Democrats are the peace party just because, you know, left-wing peace people identify easier with them than the Republicans or something, you know, wake up. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are mass murderers in waiting. Well, Hillary Clinton's already a mass murderer. They brag about this. She pushed Bill Clinton on every single one of his violent invasions. You could include Waco in that. Hillary Clinton pushed for intervention in Bosnia and Haiti, especially publicly bragged about pushing Bill to begin the air war against Serbia in 1999, to crack down on Saddam Hussein in the no-fly zones, etc., etc., etc. These are people who cannot wait to inherit the power that George Bush and Dick Cheney have built up in the presidency. And it would almost be humorous to listen to the right-wingers cry about how it's not fair that Hillary Clinton has so much power, except for how tragic it's going to be. And, of course, they won't recognize any of it as their fault. The American Jacksonians, they will not recognize that it's their fault that Hillary Clinton has so much power. You know, at a time when the presidency ought to be being completely emasculated and restricted and bound by the chains in the Constitution, we're setting it free. And the opposition, quote-unquote, are a bunch of people who completely agree with the people in power right now. So, yeah, there you go. Long live the Democratic Party of Andrew Jackson and Woodrow Wilson and Harry Truman and Bill Clinton. Man, that's a lot of blood, isn't it? I wonder, if you took the blood spilled by all the different Democrat presidents and tried to, you know, pour it all in one big vat, how big would it be? Lake Michigan, at least, right? I'm thinking maybe even the size of the Gulf of Mexico. It's a hell of a lot of blood. And only more to come. Some good news, which I don't ever get to talk about good news. South Korea's Ro seeks economic community with North. This is from Reuters. South Korean President Ro Moon-hyun said on Wednesday he hopes this month's summit with Communist North Korea, only the second in 50 years, will help the Cold War foes develop common economic interests. This has been the policy of the South Koreans for quite some time. They called it the Sunshine Policy. Let's open up some railways. Let's open up some trade. Let's get some families going back and forth. Let's get some money going back and forth. Let's work this out. Work toward a peaceful, eventual reconciliation and reunification of the Korean Peninsula. But America doesn't want that. America doesn't want a new power in Asia to have to deal with. America prefers America. There's no such thing. Uncle Sam, like the Primus song at the top of the hour. There is no Uncle Sam. Sorry, the criminals who occupy the George Bush administration the foreign policy establishment in this country, which is made up of people, they, individually and, you know, as a group carrying out policies, they don't want reunification in Korea. And so they have opposed all the efforts at the Sunshine policy to warm relations there. Made accusations against North Korea that were completely and totally unfounded in order to intimidate them and ultimately force them to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Almost succeeded in having a war. Can't believe I'm about to say this. Thank goodness for Condoleezza Rice. Oh, and, you know, this is an article from a few days ago. I guess I should have brought this up in the interview there. New York Times, August 12th. In China, a high-tech plan to track people. At least 20,000 police surveillance cameras are being installed along streets here in southern China and will soon be guided by sophisticated computer software from an American-financed company to recognize automatically the faces of police suspects and detect unusual activity. So, I'm not sure at this point whether the Chinese communists are copying us or if we're copying them. But just to let you know that our Orwellian high-tech slave state that's being set up here in the United States is, yeah, we're not alone. As the guest pointed out, it's been like this in Britain for a long time. In Britain, they'll even harass you over the loudspeaker. If they surveil you jaywalking or dropping a gum wrapper on the sidewalk, Big Brother will denounce you over the loudspeaker. In England already. And, you know, I don't know. I guess just kind of for, like, you know, science fiction, imagination kind of purposes. I think it'll be really interesting to see just exactly how the high-tech police state develops in this country over the next 10, 20 years. I think, I think it'll be, you know, half 1984 and half THX-1138. Something along those lines. Anyway, so I'm Scott, and we'll be right back with Mikey Weinstein. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
there's an army of 200 million marching down the river Euphrates coming toward the Persian Gulf. There's going to be the meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion that is unplanned for on the charts of all of the dictators of the earth. It's not an invasion from the north or the south or the east or the west. It's an invasion from heaven. And he will establish his kingdom, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. I am telling you, that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close. John the Revelator says in Revelation the 19th, "And I, John, saw the heavens open, and he that sat upon a white horse was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness doth he judge and make war. And out of his mouth shall go a two-edged sword, with which he shall smite the nations of the earth." Therefore, it is time for America to embrace the words of Senator Joseph Lieberman and consider a military preemptive strike against our land to prevent a nuclear holocaust in Israel and a nuclear attack on Iran.
The one who forces Israel into a peace treaty with the Arabs is the one who is, you have to watch out for.
Is the beast.
Right. But another reason why we support Israel, we have a common enemy.
Who is
that? Muslim.
The Quran is a false, it's absolutely not the word of God. I was a member of a mainline church, and I'm no different than a Muslim.
So we're fighting what is behind the Muslim people, which is Satan. Because Satan is the one who's actually trying to destroy the Jewish race. Because that way he would destroy God's plan.
And what will happen is Israel and the Western world, in order to save our type of civilization, have got to fight the Muslim. And if we don't take out Iran one way or another, if we move out of Iraq, the Muslims are going to take over and they're going to follow us here.
There's an army of 200 million marching down the river Euphrates coming toward the Persian Gulf. There's going to be the meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion that is unplanned for on the charts of all of the dictators of the earth. It's not an invasion from the north or the south or the east or the west. It's an invasion from heaven. And he will establish his kingdom, and of his kingdom there shall be no end. I am telling you, that makes this message one of the most thrilling prophetic messages you've ever heard in your life. You could get raptured out of this building before I get through finished preaching. We are that close. John the Revelator says in Revelation the 19th, "And I, John, saw the heavens open, and he that sat upon a white horse was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness doth he judge and make war. And out of his mouth shall go a two-edged sword, with which he shall smite the nations of the earth."
The denials by Pastor Hagee and his minions of an ulterior end times agenda were directly contradicted by members of their own organization.
Basically, I believe that you have to embrace Israel as part of the second coming.
But when the battle of Armageddon is over and they come out of hiding and they see him and he tells them who he is, they say, "Who is this?"
The Jews will accept Christ.
The Jews accept Christ as a nation then, and they are restored.
The Jews are God's chosen people, but they will, I mean, they have to be witnessed to just like anybody else.
Yeah.
There's only one way to heaven, and that's in John 14:6.
What's going to happen to the non-believer?
All right, folks, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and the next guest is Mikey Weinstein. He's the founder of the Military Religious Freedom Association, graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy, and a lawyer in the Reagan administration. Welcome to the show, sir.
I'm happy to be here.
And so the big news is that there's a new report by the Inspector General of the Pentagon. Is that right?
Yes, that came out just a few days ago, finding seven senior officers in the Pentagon in violation of the uniform wearing regulations and exonerating several political appointees. You know, we consider that the report is very weak and very anemic. The report itself, by its own definition, exempted itself from DOD Directive 1300.17, which is an internal Pentagon regulation entitled "Accommodating the Religious Practices of Accommodation of Religious Practices Within the Military Services." By exempting the the investigation from the proselytizing, which the Pentagon said nobody in this video, which, by the way, if your listeners want to see it, it's the Christian Embassy video. It's on our website. We're a nonprofit charity, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. You guys can go see for yourself at www.militaryreligiousfreedom.org. O-R-G. The report said that this was simply an issue about improperly wearing a uniform, which is as much a lie as trying to state that Jessica Lynch was a female Rambo and that Pat Tillman was killed and mowed down in a withering field of Al-Qaeda fire.
Well, what was it that had actually happened?
What happened was that you have, again, if you go look at the video, you have senior members of the Pentagon, generals, colonels, and political appointees that are supporting an organization that was referred to as a dominionist, fundamentalist, Christian, far-right-wing sect called the Christian Embassy, a little-known entity that has a ministry. It's been around for about 25, 30 years. It's an outgrowth from Dr. Bill Bright's Campus Crusade for Christ. And they minister to the glitterati and cognoscenti in Washington, D.C., only on Capitol Hill, the State Department, and the Pentagon. The video opens up, and again, everybody who's listening, just go to www.militaryreligiousfreedom.org and look at the video yourself. It's about 11 minutes long. It states that the Christian Embassy, through the use of Bible studies, daily prayer breakfasts, and outreach events, they use the word mustering, meaning lining up all troops as for battle. All 25,000 men and women who work in the corridors and rings of the Pentagon into, quote, an intentional relationship with Jesus Christ. It is, you have generals claiming that they are the aroma of Jesus Christ in the Pentagon in uniform, violating so many regulations and internal laws that, you know, I mean, it's unbelievable, but most importantly, massively violating the Constitution of the United States and their oaths that they took to protect and, preserve, support, and defend the Constitution.
Haven't the courts already found that you can't do this kind of thing?
Yes, it says that we have literally scores of years of wonderful U.S. Supreme Court case law saying that, you know, you can believe whatever you want, but you can and you can proselytize. And of course, any religious faith can, but you cannot engage the machinery of the state to do this. What you're seeing are seven senior officers and major political appointees, some of whom were exonerated, that are making their own biblical worldview, which is this fundamentalist, dominionist, weaponized gospel of Jesus Christ, de facto American foreign policy and domestic policy. In fact, the report itself is interesting because it states that one of the generals that was slightly admonished, again, I think they're going to make all seven military members probably eat some strawberry and chocolate cupcakes, you know, after they're too filled from dinner or lunch as their penalty. But one of the major generals was, his job was to be our liaison in Turkey to our closest Islamic allies, the country of Turkey, and the Turkish general staff, to be our best military, American military and political liaison. Well, the Turkish leading newspaper, Sabah, S-A-B-A-H, picked this story up after we broke it last December, our Military Religious Freedom Foundation, and they identified this major general with a picture of the paper and a story that he was a member of a fundamentalist extremist religious sect, and the Turkish general staff called him in on the carpet because they are assiduously secular in Turkey. There's a huge separation between mosque and state there, and that's how embarrassing it's gotten when Turkish senior generals have to call in American generals to remind the American generals of the importance of the oath they took to support the American Constitution. If this is how our Islamic allies are reacting, embarrassment and fury, can you imagine the propaganda value of that Christian embassy video in the hands of Osama bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi? He's dead, but his followers, the jihadists, the insurrectionists, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah's Hezbollah, Hamas, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Islamic Jihad. That's why these officers should have been court-martialed. Pete Guerin, the current Secretary of the Army, should be fired and tried. And that, you know, this Christian Embassy video, again, at militaryreligiousfreedom.org, which you can see for yourself, is the best propaganda film that you could possibly have for our enemies. It is emboldening and making it already, you know, easy for already angry Islamic men and young women. Young men and women in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, who want to come and join the cause against us. It's just it's atrocious, and the report by the Pentagon's inspector generals is equally as weak.
And now, what about the propagandizing of American soldiers? I talked to a friend of mine who said that he heard from a friend of his who, I don't know if he was in Iraq or just got back from Iraq, who said, well, I know that this whole bringing the Iraqis freedom is actually a lie. But the real thing is, we're there waiting for the next war, which is going to be against Russia and Iran. And, you know, that's straight out of the mouth of John Hagee and the Dominionists.
The problem with the Dominionist Christians, the fundamentalist Dominionist Christians, and they're a minority. They're a fringe element even of Christendom here in America, but they represent 12.6% of the American public, which is still 38 million people. Everything, they have a playbook for every second of every day. You know, today's Wednesday at 4:02 p.m. Central Time. They'll know exactly that you're probably supposed to go floss your teeth. Their playbook is this concept of eschatology, the end times, the Book of Revelation, and they are completely infusing their own biblical worldviews, which are very digital, ones or zeros. Either you're with us or you're against us. They'll quote Matthew book chapter 12, verse 30, where in their interpretation Jesus says, those who are not with me are against me. And they're all about wanting to start the big bar fight in the sky by going into a Western saloon with two cowboys at either end of the bar and whispering in the ear of each one an insult that the other supposedly said to each other. You liquor them both up, get that bar fight going, and that serves as an accelerant or lubricant to bring Jesus back and want to be fun because the blood will run hip deep.
Yep. Now, what do you make of the Israel lobby's alliance with these fundamentalist Christians?
Well, I get it from, I'm Jewish, but I get it from both sides. I think that Israel needs to stop looking at its friends solely through the prism of who's giving them money, because I get it from, the John Hagee's, the D. James Kennedy's, used to be Falwell, of course, he's dead. Pat Robertson, the currently disgraced Ed Haggard. These people are all convinced that, they always say, Mikey, how come you're fighting us? We love you Jews in Israel. Yeah, they love it to the same extent that the pilgrims love the church for the first Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I mean, and that really is what it is. They'll tell you openly that, look, our point here is to force Jesus to come back and kill everyone, and then we'll go to heaven, and everyone else will have to go through the tribulation and then burn in hell forever. I mean,
they do not want peace. That's why the Dominionist Christians were so happy last year when Hezbollah went to war, with the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, because they just want this all to start. They're tired of waiting for Jesus to come back. They want to accelerate it, so they'll do whatever they can to do it, and that's why this represents a national security threat internally to this country. Just like you can see on the Christian Embassy video at our website, militaryreligiousfreedom.org, and please consider buying my book from the largest publisher in New York, With God on Our Side, One Man's War Against an Evangelical Coup in America's Military. It tells you how this all started, and they're all about this concept of wanting to bring about the big fight, and that's this is why this represents, again, a national security threat internally every bit as much in magnitude, width, and breadth as that which is now represented and challenging us externally by the resurgent Taliban and an al-Qaeda that our most recent national intelligence estimate has determined is at least as strong as it was on 9/11.
Well, now let me ask you, when you say national security threat, that's the kind of language that the right-wingers used against domestic communists in the 50s and stuff. Are you saying that some extraordinary measures should be taken against them or something?
Well, look, I mean, if we're going to talk about corrective measures, I mean, let's first court-martial, these officers who did this for violating their oath to the Constitution.
Oh, you'll get no argument from me there.
We got to have some heads hanging from the Pentagon. But what is it going to take? What is it going to take? This problem is existent all throughout the Department of Defense. We have 737 U.S. military installations that the Pentagon at least acknowledges that we have that are scattered around the globe as we garrison the planet in 132 countries. And on every one of those now, we have multiple organizations that are just like the Christian Embassy. One's called the Officers Christian Fellowship for the officers. The other one is the Christian Military Fellowship for the enlisted. And they have a tripartite or three-level goal that they're unabashed about. It's right on their website. These are goals that they view as least as much more important than the oaths that they've all taken to, swore an oath to protect us and defend the Constitution of the United States. I can't make this stuff up. I mean, put on your seatbelt. The first goal is they want to see, quote, a spiritually transformed U.S. military. Goal number two, with ambassadors for Christ in uniform. Goal number three, empowered by the Holy Spirit. This is all, again, if I'm walking through a mall, if I'm at a state fair, if I'm in a restaurant, I am fair, even if I'm mowing my front yard, I'm fair game to be evangelized by anybody who wants to do it, because it's a level playing field. But in this country, if you're being even gently evangelized by your shift manager at Starbucks or Wendy's or Costco or KFC, that violates Title VII of the U.S. Code, and it's a killer lawsuit against any corporation. which is exactly why this behavior would last 3 seconds in the private sector.
Right.
But in the U.S. military, that's not just your shift manager at Starbucks, as well you know. That is your military superior. The Pentagon itself is so concerned about this draconian specter of command influence that they actually have regulations on the book that prohibit military superiors up and down the chain of command from pushing Tupperware or Mary Kay Cosmetics or Amway on their subordinates. That's how concerned they are. So, you know, as I said before, if you're being even gently evangelized in the U.S. military by your superiors, get out of my damn face, sir or ma'am, is not an option for you. And as George Orwell stated, when you're facing universal deceit, speaking the truth itself is a revolutionary act. And, brother, I'm going to tell you, we do not train our honorable, noble, young sailors, soldiers, Marines, and airmen to be revolutionaries. They're supposed to smartly salute, go do their jobs. And that's why our foundation, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, a nonprofit charity, is here, because we fight for them.
Yeah, and that really does sound like a national security threat, like that anecdote I told you where this American foot soldier from Iraq comes back and, you know, the word through the grapevine is that we're going to have a war with Russia and China. It sounds like this propaganda is at least somewhat successful on the average soldier on the ground over there.
Well, I was just contacted by the mother of a U.S. Marine pilot who was outraged about the fact that when her son was going through a pilot training, an instructor on behalf of the Marine Corps and Navy from Lockheed Martin was explained to them in a class that was supposed to be about aircraft safety, about how important it was to hate all of the sons and daughters of Hagar, all Arabs, and to kill all Arabs and to kill all of their families. I get this around the clock. That's why this, you're entitled to any view that you want. You're not entitled to use your position of employment, and it's like a gazillion times worse in the military when you're using this draconian specter of command influence on a lower ranking person to push this particular weaponized gospel of Jesus Christ. We've had over 5,000 members of the U.S. Marine Corps, Navy, Army, and Air Force, and veterans come to our foundation, brother, as tormentees.
And over 5,000. 96%
of those coming in are Christians themselves. 3/4 are traditional Protestants, you know, Presbyterians, Lutherans, Methodists, Episcopalians. We even get Assemblies of God, Church of Christ, and Baptists. 1/4 are Roman Catholic. About 4-4.5% are going to be Jewish, Islamic, you know, the usual minority faith, Buddhist, Hindu, Wiccan, atheist, or agnostics. This is basically a fundamentalist, dominionist Christian situation where they are praying, P-R-A-Y and P-R-E-Y, on fellow Christians, telling them, you know what, you're a Christian, but you're not Christian enough for us, and as a result, you'll burn eternally in hell along with the Jews.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and one of the most important points out of so many here is one that you brought up before, and I guess the one we'll have to end with, is I want to reiterate when you talk about that Marine pilot being instructed that, you know, all Muslims are the sons of Hagar and he's supposed to hate them, etc. That plays perfectly into the propaganda of Osama bin Laden, who is trying to convince the people of the Islamic world that no matter what the American politicians say on TV, their real motivation is they are at war against Islam. And that's why you ought to be willing to kill yourself.
You're absolutely correct, and that's why this is causing the deaths of American men and women in uniform, because it's emboldening the enemy. And I mean, look, I had an email last night that referred to my name not as Mikey but as Kikey, and when I confronted the person via the email, this is after I made a national appearance on Fox News on a special report with Brit Hume, the guy actually called back on the phone and found my phone number today on the website. We have an 800 toll free number, saying that he, you know, that using the word kike wasn't really anti-Semitic. And I went, okay, brother, you know what? We'll talk another time. I've got some other shows I've got to do. I love doing your show, and I would once again exhort everybody to please go to www.militaryreligiousfreedom.org. Buy my book, but go take a look at that Christian Embassy video. You can see the DODIG report that we're talking about on this great show today. And, you know, consider making a tax-free deduction, fully tax-deductible donation to our foundation and help us fight this massive, wretched, heinous, unconstitutional heart of darkness that comes from dominionist Christians that, when they try to engage the machinery of the state, are showing the most wretched combination you could have of two human traits, heartlessness and zealousness, and I might throw unconstitutionality in there also.
All right. Great interview. Thank you very much. Mikey Weinstein, everybody, founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, author of God, With God on Our Side. Thanks again.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. Our next guest is Stu Bykofsky. He's a writer for the Philadelphia Daily News. I hope I got that right. Yeah, Philadelphia Daily News. Welcome to the show, Stu.
Happy to be here.
Good to talk to you, sir. And, well, as you already know, just from the name of the show, you and I are going to disagree, but this isn't the Sean Hannity show, so let's you and I be friends. And let's not get into one of those arguments where we each begin each sentence with, you believe this and you believe that, because I don't want it to be like that.
But
I have to say, Phil, Stu, pardon me, I have a serious problem with the sentiment expressed in your recent column, to save America, we need another 9/11. What's going on there?
Well, what's going on, first of all, is the headline does not express what the text of the column does. The word need is wrong. Read the first sentence of the column, if you would, Scott. Your listeners know what we're talking about.
Sure, sure. 1 month from the anniversary, I'm thinking another 9/11 would help America.
Okay. Help as opposed to need an attack. What that is, one man's opinion. It was my hypothesis. And what the column expressed was, remembering the unity that we felt as Americans after 9/11, I kind of yearned for that. I see we're terribly divided today. And I speculated on whether or not an attack would do that. At the close of the column, I acknowledged that the unity brought by such an attack sadly won't last forever. The first 9/11 proved that. So I'm acknowledging it is not a cure-all, and it was an idea I was throwing out there to underscore my belief that we're terribly fractured, and there was reaction to the column, which I published on Monday, in which I said I was wrong. An attack won't do it. We are so badly fractured. I don't think of anything that can do it.
Oh, and my apologies, because I'm just now seeing in the margin here that you wrote another column following up, which I haven't read. So
okay.
My apologies for that. But
that's okay.
But here's the thing. It seems to me that the reason we're so divided is because of all the things that our government was able to get away with by exploiting all that unity that we felt on September 11th. Wouldn't we be all better off if we could find unity around the Bill of Rights rather than around an aggressive foreign policy?
Well, what I decided, my opinion in the column, was that the fracture that we see in America today flows mostly from Iraq, the attack and the prosecution of the war that was botched by Bush. I'll leave it at that. That the war itself, because it has dragged on for 4 years, because there is no victory in sight, because there are casualties every day, that is what has turned people against the war. Rather than the war, people being against the war itself. My illustration of that point of view would be the first Gulf War, which lasted 100 hours of actual fighting where we had a declared attack. If there were people who, of course, were against that war, too, but they were a very small minority. And as time passed, that has receded into the distance. It is not it is not open for national debate anymore because we won that war and we won it quickly.
Well, but see, I'd agree with you that the American people were almost entirely happy with that war. But I mean,
okay.
Isn't the lesson of that first Gulf War that no, we didn't win it? We got ourselves into another Vietnam situation where this thing began in January of 1991, and we're still bombing that place, and
well,
never stopped.
You're actually sounding like people from the right now, who say we didn't win the war because we didn't finish it off. George H.W. Bush should have gone in and taken it over right then and there.
Well, of course,
had
that's
we
not
done,
what I said.
Had we done that. Now, I don't make that case. I think that's wrong thinking.
Well,
but that's what the right
I do, too.
Saying.
I do, too. And that's why I opposed the second Gulf War. It was basically sold as finishing the job of George Bush Sr. And, of course,
I'm sorry, Scott.
It didn't finish the job
that way. That may be the truth, as you say. It was never sold that way.
Well,
it was sold as weapons of mass destruction.
Well, in a way, honestly, that was how it was sold to the rubes. If you watched Meet the Press, it was sold as regime change. It was sold as this guy is no longer tolerable that he's there, and so we're going to go in and finish the job from last time.
Well, Saddam is the bad guy. I don't recall anyone saying we're going to finish the job from last time, but that's a minor point.
Yeah, I mean, the point I'm making is not that they should have, quote-unquote, finished the job back in 1991. The point that I'm making is that the war in 1991 never ended. It still hasn't ended. This is still the same war. And it wasn't declared. You said that was a declared war, I think. It was not a declared war. It was not in defense of America or even American interests. It was.
Oh, you're talking about the current Iraq war?
No, I'm talking about the first one that got us into this mess in 1991 that the American people still love so much.
I believe the first one was authorized by the United Nations.
Yeah. Well, that's not a declaration of war from the United States Congress as mandated by the Constitution.
Well, that's
and it was
right.
Not, and it was certainly not in defense of America.
When was the last time we had one of those? I don't even think Korea was.
No, it was 1941. 1941 was the last time Congress declared war.
That's right. We don't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, we ought to. If we're going to have a war, I think the responsibility ought to be on the lawmakers. That's what Madison and them thought when they wrote the Constitution, too.
I agree with you.
But so now we're too far off the point here. Well, let's get to the second Iraq War. You say that the problem that the American people have is the mismanagement of it rather than the war itself. I would submit to you, sir, that there was no proper way to manage it. Whether they made a giant mistake firing the Iraqi army and so forth is debatable, although I think if they'd tried to keep the Ba'athists in power and the Iraqi army, they'd have had to start the war all over again against the Shiites, who were not going to tolerate that. That's why they fired them, is because the Ayatollah Sistani insisted on it.
Yep.
And so there was no right way to wage this aggressive war to somehow guarantee a new form of government and impose it on the people of that country. There was no right way to do that. And if the American people, and it is a minority according to the polls, the latest ones I've read, if those Americans think that the war was still right but it was just waged wrong, well, they're still just mistaken. And what we're talking about is America was attacked by a stateless band of guerrilla fighters left over from the war against the Russians that America supported. They were basically out of work. The king of Saudi Arabia wouldn't hire them to oust Saddam from Kuwait, hired us to do it instead. Some of them went and fought in Bosnia for Bill Clinton in the 1990s and in Kosovo in 1999 there at the end of the last century. And they decided that they couldn't overthrow their local governments they wanted to overthrow until they got rid of us first. So they would come and knock down our towers and get us to overreact and invade their land where they could shoot our guys and drain our treasury until our empire was so bankrupt they could force us out. And now, it seems to me like George Bush is doing, and this entire policy has been exactly what Osama bin Laden wants, and it seems to me that it's also the kind of thing that makes it much more likely that we'll have that next September 11th, when really what we're talking about is a war that could have been over in 6 months if it had been targeted against the actual Mujahideen warriors that knocked those towers down, instead of the Ba'athists, who were number three on their list.
Wasn't that what we were doing in Afghanistan?
Well, actually, no. In Afghanistan, they went and they waged war against the Taliban and they let al-Qaeda escape.
Well, but weren't we after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and wasn't that where they were?
That is where they were, but they really assumed, and Tommy Franks even said, Osama bin Laden is not our target. We're here for regime change against the Taliban, and I'm sure that there were some who would have liked to get him at Tora Bora, and I'm not saying that, you know, it was necessarily on purpose, but bin Laden and his top guys got away, and now we're stuck overthrowing the Taliban and trying to install Hamid Lando Calrissian Karzai in power there with his cape and his furry hat and the rest of it. And what do we have? A resurgent Taliban, a resurgent al-Qaeda, stronger than ever, according to the latest national intelligence estimate. And it seems to me like this unity that you talk about, I mean, I kind of like the spirit of, hey, we can all get along and not have to fight among each other all the time and what have you. But if that unity is to be exploited by our government to wage war on innocent people to make our terrorism problem so much worse, then what's the good of it? Wouldn't we be better off as individualists?
Did I hear, were you critical of the United States intervention in Bosnia under Bill Clinton?
Yes, that war was fought basically for the Mujahideen. I mean, Bin Laden's guys were used as shock troops in that war.
Okay, but it wasn't to save Muslims who were being rounded up and exterminated.
No, I don't think it was.
Wow.
I mean, particularly when you're talking about the Kosovo War.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, well, no, the Kosovo War, there were no mass graves. The FBI left after 2 weeks. They found a total of 3,000 bodies. All of them were of fighting-age men. There were no men, women, and children rounded up and shot and dumped in mass graves. The Clinton administration promised us hundreds of thousands of bodies, and they never found them any better than they found Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. They didn't exist. It was a lie. And in fact, it was Hillary Clinton, as we were just discussing in the last half hour here on the show. It was Hillary Clinton, and she's bragged about this publicly, who called Bill Clinton and basically browbeat him into going ahead and starting the bombing based on that lie. There was no genocide in Kosovo.
There was, and there were no concentration camps with starving Muslims. Those pictures were all faked.
Well, there was.
I saw them, Scott.
There was footage of Kosovar refugees from after the bombing began, fleeing to Albania. I saw that footage on CNN too. But I'm telling you, sir, do the Google search. There were no mass graves. They found a total of like 3,000 bodies total, and they weren't civilians. There were no mass graves. They promised us 100,000 bodies from that war that had already been killed. That was the genocide they were stopping. And they used the Mujahideen. In fact, Brendan O'Neill has written all about this, how Bill Clinton really strengthened al-Qaeda and really internationalized the modern jihadist movement by backing them in Kosovo. And it did not serve American interests one bit whatsoever.
Scott, I'm glad to hear that you're criticizing Democrats as well as Republicans on the basis of information.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a partisan toward freedom. I mean, what I want to live in a free society. And so whichever administration is working against my liberty, they're the target of my criticism.
Mm-hmm.
And again, let's get back to the original point here. Americans got along a lot better in the days and weeks and months after September 11th. People stopped calling 911 on each other so much. People stopped fist fighting in bars so much. And the level of the tragedy got to us in a way. Everybody put a America United and all that on the car. But
My
fundamental question to you is that really a good thing? Wouldn't we have been better off if 90% of the American people had said, wait a minute, George Bush and Dick Cheney are the same people they were on September 10th, and they shouldn't be trusted with any more power or authority than we would have trusted them with on September 10th. And no, not everything has changed. The Bill of Rights has not changed. The constitutional separation of powers has not changed. And the fact that it is immoral to wage aggressive war against countries who have never attacked us has not changed.
Scott, do you remember that the administration and CIA and FBI were criticized for failure to connect the dots?
Absolutely.
Okay. What I see now is that the left, by and large, will not give the administration the ability to connect the dots by lawful eavesdropping. I'm against
unlawful eavesdropping. The Democrats just passed it last week. The president can tap anybody he wants, and the paper says today that George Bush is now telling the courts that they may not even review any lawsuits about warrantless wiretapping because it would violate the state's secrets privilege
that was made up by the courts in the
first place.
He was given the authority after he had usurped the authority.
Right, and
I am certainly not for that. But why did the Democrats give him the authority? Because they don't want to be accused after the next attack. And, Scott, you know in your heart we will be attacked again.
As long as we continue this foreign policy, I absolutely believe that's true.
Our foreign policy at this moment has nothing to do with it. We will be attacked again. There are already al-Qaeda cells in this country. You don't want to believe it? Fine. But, gee, somebody attacked the World Trade Center in 1993 and was convicted of the crime.
Yeah, and
now that wasn't imagined, was it?
And you're telling me
you don't want to believe
those guys
that
are still out on the loose.
There are cells in this country. You're free not to believe it. I choose to believe it, and I would encourage our government to do something to protect us against it.
Well, you know, I'm happy with people believing whatever they want. What I'd like to see is some evidence. I mean, what I've seen is the director of the FBI
convictions.
I've seen the director of the FBI testifying under oath before the United States Senate that they have no evidence whatsoever of any current al-Qaeda cells inside the continental United States whatsoever.
And you believe everything he tells you?
Well, I believe him when he says, we have no evidence, we're looking, but we can't find any. I believe that.
Look, the AP today is carrying a story about citizens banding together into, well, I'll tell you to look it up, and you can read it for your readers, your listeners. I don't want to do it over the phone. A story by Tom Hayes on the Associated Press about groups that believe that are joining together and being radicalized to air their grievances through terrorism. As I said, we've already had a conviction. There were others. There was a conviction in Detroit. We have people who are going on trial.
I'm really glad that you mentioned.
We have people who are going on trial for a supposed attack on Kennedy Airport. Now, I'm not saying they're guilty, and I'm not saying the plot is actual. Let's have the trial and see what happens.
Right. Well, let me stop you there. First of all, I never denied that Ramzi Youssef and what became the Al-Qaeda movement were responsible for September 11th or for the first World Trade Center bombing or any of those attacks through the 90s. I never denied any of that. So let's just get that straight. And secondly, you cite the Detroit case there. You know that they only got convictions on two out of the four, and then the judge turned around and let the two convicted go free because the prosecutor and the guys from the State Department were being indicted for perjury and suborning perjury and withholding evidence from the defense, that they were convicted on the basis of thin air, and the judge overturned their convictions, and the Justice Department is now prosecuting the federal prosecutor who persecuted them. And so, again, I'm not denying there's such a thing as Al-Qaeda or that there's a threat to this country. Let's not go cite a bunch of bogus make-believe terrorism cases that the FBI has conjured out of thin air to support our case now, Stu. There is a real terrorist threat to this country. And the fact of the matter is you talk about these guys being radicalized. They're not being radicalized by a speech on some audio tape. They're being radicalized by watching the American military occupy their holy land and killing people who look and believe like them. That's why they're being radicalized. That's why they were being radicalized in the 1990s. You mentioned Ramzi Youssef and the first World Trade Center bombing. Yeah. Have you ever read his rant to the judge upon his conviction when he gave his statement to the court? This is all about American foreign policy. It's always been about American foreign policy. And if they attacked us because we're occupying their holy land and putting sanctions on them and bombing them, well, then occupying their holy land and putting sanctions on them and bombing them more is not going to solve the problem. See, that's going to make the problem worse. Again, we started off on September 12th at war against a stateless band of Mujahideen warriors who didn't control so much as a county on earth. You know, they were kind of an adjunct alliance with the Taliban, but they weren't even the government of Afghanistan. They were nothing. They were a band of pirates. And now
we act like they're the Soviet Union. But I told your producer I have 15 minutes for the interview. I've done 15 minutes.
All right. Well,
I'm glad it was civil. And it was nice talking to you, but I've got to get back to work.
Okay, well, I'd like to give you a chance to go ahead and answer that last bit if you want, if you'd like.
I have a real job to do here, Scott, and I've given you actually more time than most interviewers, which want to do it in 5 or 7, but I really do have to get back to work. I appreciate talking to you, and I appreciate your point of view.
All right, thanks very much. Sure. Everybody, Stu Bykofsky from the Philadelphia Daily News. Missing that feeling of unity from the September 11th attacks. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin. really too bad what happened to Metallica. Those guys used to rock in my childhood, man. We used to rock out to Kill 'Em All. And now look at them. Pathetic. Anyway, boy, oh boy. Yeah, I'm Scott. So what do you guys think? Need another September 11th to unify America around aggressive warfare and unrestrained federal government in D.C.? Sound good? 646-6446. 646-6446. If you're calling from out of town, throw a 512 on there. 512-646-6446. I'll be happy to take y'all's calls. If you want to discuss the cameras, the premillennialist, dispensationalist, eschatologist, born-again, rapturist, crazy-ass Christians taking over the United States military, or the wonderful benefits to American society that come from having 3,000 civilians killed in a day on our own soil. Padilla. You can call in if you have something to say about this. I have something to say about this. Jose Padilla, innocent man. If that jury convicts them, then damn them to hell. The jury is now sitting and deliberating on this case of Jose Padilla right now. And they got nothing on him. Nothing. Oh, he's a dirty bomber, says John Ashcroft, live via satellite from Moscow. He's a dirty bomber. That's why he doesn't get a trial. That's why we're turning him over to Don Rumsfeld and the U.S. Navy to be tortured. Because he's such a dangerous guy. And then look at this farce of a kangaroo court, star chamber, show trial, just ridiculous theater put on for the juries down there in Miami. Oh, yeah, I expect you to sit here for 6 weeks and listen to me tell you about these other two guys who we monitored for 13 years without doing anything to them. That's how dangerous they were. And then at the end of the show, I'll tell you after 6 weeks. Oh, yeah, and Padilla. Yeah, he was with them, too. They got nothing on Padilla. Who is Jose Padilla? Jose Padilla is a former Taco Bell employee. Born in Brooklyn, raised in Chicago, if I remember right, maybe it was the other way around. Arrested, an American citizen, arrested, unarmed, on American soil by domestic police, held as a material witness as the FBI agent who detained him, attempted to get him to turn into a rat, and set up some other guys for a plot to set off a dirty bomb, which, of course, they would stop. And be heroes and save the day, and it would be a sting operation, right? That always goes off without a hitch. But Padilla refused to be a snitch. He was being held as a material witness. He wasn't even charged with a crime. The officer said he didn't think. He said this at one of the hearings before the trial. Under oath, the FBI agent says, "I didn't think Padilla was a threat. I wanted to use him as a snitch." And then when the Supreme Court was, and then the judge said, "Well, bring this defendant before me." And the prosecutor said, "No, judge, we already turned him over to the Navy to be tortured." And the Navy held him and tortured him for 2 years. Now the man's crazy. Now he's mentally defective. Because the U.S. Navy, probably with help and instruction from the CIA, used Nazi and Soviet torture techniques on this guy. Oh, look, not a bruise on him. All we did was deprive him of sensory information for 2 years. Oh, no, but we never hung him from his toes. We never sick dogs on him like those unfortunate folks at Abu Ghraib or raped their little sisters like at Abu Ghraib. No, see, look at him. He's fine. Not a bruise on him. We just left him chained to his empty cell in his empty cell block. And left him there with the lights on for 2 years without any sensory information whatsoever. Well, he's perfectly fine. Not a bruise on. In fact, you look at the pictures of Jose Padilla. Go to Google Images and look at Jose Padilla, and you'll see the cops leading him by his shackles. They will not even so much as put a hand on his shoulder. They hold the chains as they pull him around with blackout goggles over his eyes, with gunshot muffler things over his ears, to deprive him of all sensory information, all human contact. And then they turn him over. Oh, the Supreme Court was about to rule, hey, you can't do this. And so they panicked. And then they turned him over to the criminal justice system. Charged him with some felonies. Basically tacked his name onto the end of an indictment against two other guys who, again, had been monitored for 13 years. And, you know, stand accused of sending some money to a guy who sent some money to a guy who was fighting a holy war in Chechnya. In Bosnia, where, as you just heard, America fought on the side of the terrorists. They tortured him. An American citizen. And why'd they turn him over to the Navy? Because he was so dangerous, he was going to set off a dirty bomb, he was going to blow up a bunch of apartment buildings and kill a bunch of civilians. No, they turned him over to the Navy because they had nothing on him. They turned him over to the Navy because Jose Padilla was innocent. If they had attempted to charge him and convict him, he would have been acquitted. And that wouldn't do. So they turned him over to the Navy and attempted to set the precedent that they can abduct your family members and turn them over to the Navy to be tortured too. And, you know, the Supreme Court ruled in Hamdan last summer, nope, can't do that unless Congress says it's okay. And Congress immediately turned around and said it was okay. Passed the Military Commissions Act of 2006. And if Jose Padilla was arrested in New York now, he would get one habeas corpus hearing before the judge. They wouldn't just turn him straight over to the Navy. But they would say to the judge, judge, he's a terrorist. Trust us, we have classified information you can't know about, but he's a terrorist, all right? And that would be the end of his habeas hearing, and off to the Navy to be tortured he would go. It's unbelievable that the American population as a whole is not marching on Washington to tear it all down brick by brick by now. You know, I had the guest on who wrote the book about all the inmates at Guantanamo Bay last week. They're innocent. A lot of times they're having to hold three different trials before they can find some officers who will agree that somebody's guilty. In the total military star chamber, communist Cuba style, I don't know what you call them, phony trials that are being held down there at Guantanamo Bay. They're innocent. Hamdi, another American citizen, born in Louisiana. The most dangerous man in the whole world, except when it came time for the U.S. Supreme Court to tell the U.S. government, oh no, this man gets a trial. He's an American. They let him go. They let him go. He's back now in Saudi Arabia, perhaps being tortured to death there. I don't know. Good luck to you, Mr. Hamdi. Hope you're still okay out there. David Hicks, the Australian. He was innocent. This guy went from being the most dangerous man in the world. Well, I'm sorry. He went from being Bill Clinton's ally, Mujahideen warrior in Bosnia, to being the most dangerous man in the world, to getting a plea bargain of 9 months as long as he promises to sign a piece of paper promising to never tell the world how badly he was tortured in American custody. This is what we get from unifying on September 12th, right? This is what we get for saying, oh my God, this is terrible. Let's all pretend that instead of individuals, we're all one. And the president is our head. And he decides. This is what we get for our unity. Innocent people being tortured by our military. Innocent American citizens. Of course, they're the only human beings in the world who have rights. It's not like rights are natural things. Who ever heard of natural rights? No. Rights are things granted to us by our benevolent Republicans in power. And if they don't grant rights to foreigners, by golly, those foreigners just don't have them. But Padilla, he was an American. is an American and an innocent one. And you know what his defense attorneys did when it was time for them to present their case in the Miami courtroom a couple days ago? They said, we don't have a case to present, Your Honor. The government didn't present a case at all. They've done nothing to convict our client. And we're not even going to call a single witness. Go ahead and deliberate, jury. We're betting dollars to dimes that you acquit our client. Because the government didn't prove a damned thing about him. Well, that worked in the Ruby Ridge trial. That's what they did in the Ruby Ridge trial. They said, well, we think we've done a good enough defense on cross-examination here that we don't feel we need to call any witnesses. We'll see what happens. I'm pessimistic, man. I'm pessimistic. I mean, who's on a jury except 12 people who were too stupid to be able to figure out how to get out of jury duty? Right? And, of course, as Jacob Hornberger says, if the jury acquits him, well, the military may very well just go ahead and kidnap him and take him back to his dungeon to be tortured anyway. It's legal now. It does double jeopardy? No, no, no. That doesn't count. That would count in a federal courtroom, maybe. That doesn't count when you're talking about military justice. I can't wait for that. For Padilla to walk out of the courtroom a free man and then to be abducted by the U.S. Navy again and taken back to his cell to be tortured some more, perhaps to death. It's funny. I guess the only reason that I'm still free to say these things on the radio without having the SWAT team come and kick in my door right now and put an end to this is because none of you give a shit. Nobody even cares. Yeah, aggressive war, torture, kidnapping, mass murder on a Saddam Hussein-like scale. Tapping all of our phones, reading all our emails without warrants. Paying our local government agencies to put up surveillance cameras and integrate them all into big databases. Keeping track of our every purchase. Looking at our bank accounts, again, without any judicial check whatsoever. And nobody even cares. I can sit up here for 2 hours every day until I die of it. And not enough Americans care. It makes me wonder why they haven't just gone ahead for the clampdown. What are they waiting for? Why not come on TV and say there is no Constitution? We exist. And we don't exist because the Constitution created our power. We exist because we got the guns. What? Your rule of law is dead. You are now our slaves. What are they waiting for? What do they think, that anybody would fight back? They think that anybody would care if they just started rounding up 10 people out of every neighborhood and giving them all the Jose Padilla treatment? I mean, if they really thought that it mattered that people were dissenting, they would be doing something about it, right? They're not even worried. All the dissent in the world doesn't matter because nobody else cares. I mean, I guess the people who care care. But that's it. And our numbers aren't growing. So, I don't know. I guess for all you who don't care, I hope it's you that gets kidnapped by the Navy and tortured. And then while you're lying there on the floor trying to remember how to think in language because it's been so long since you had any sensory input whatsoever from another human being, you can try vaguely to piece together the thought that it's all your goddamn fault. Sorry, I kind of got a chip on my shoulder about this Padilla thing. Does it matter that every single person, every group of people who've been prosecuted one way or another, with or without the law, for being terrorists since September 11th have been innocent? That it's all bull? That when old Stu tries to cite some dangerous Al-Qaeda cell in America, the best he can come up with is the Detroit case? Oh, well, that's somebody else's son being tortured in a naval brig. What do I care? It's not me, so what do I care? I don't. Torture my neighbors all you want. I'm just an American. It's not like there's a legacy of liberty that's being given up here or anything, right? This is just the way it goes. We like it this way. It makes us feel safe. The Boston Globe reports 71% of the American people are all in favor of the national government buying cameras for their local cops to put up everywhere. 71%! No problem. I don't see a problem. I never heard anybody say why it might be a problem. I sure can't think of a reason why it might be a problem. Why not have government cameras everywhere? My grandpa never taught me that I was born in a free country and that it was my responsibility to keep it that way. Never heard such a crazy idea. The hell do I care? If you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have anything to worry about. Ask Jose Padilla. Ask Yasser Hamdi. Oh, he was guilty of helping the Taliban fight the Northern Alliance, who were the guys who fought on the side of the Russians. Well, some of them were. Some of them fought against the Russians, I guess. It's kind of hard to pick and choose. Oh, guilty. That terrible Hamdi fighting the Northern Alliance, why, he might as well have been at war against you and me, right? We are the Northern Alliance, aren't we? Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. Wait, don't talk yet. I got to click a button first. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, Scott. Steve, real quick, I've been running around, so I may have missed it if you brought it up, but one dimension I didn't think you brought up, and if I missed it, I apologize, regarding the federal cameras, is that if federal cameras are used by the local police, that may also be used as a construct to obtain federal jurisdiction on what is properly a local court matter.
Oh, interesting angle.
Will Grigg wrote an article about that. It wasn't concerning cameras. It was police vehicles bought with federal funds.
Right.
Where they then usurped federal jurisdiction from the localities. I don't know if you brought that up. If you hadn't, I just wanted to bring it up, and I'll hang up now.
Okay, I appreciate the call very much. No, I hadn't brought that up, and you're absolutely right. There was a court case in San Francisco, I believe it was, where the national government said, hey, we helped pay for the cop cars, and these people are charged with damage to cop cars. And so they made it a federal case, or at least they tried. I didn't follow that one. I wish I had. But, yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, I don't think it's going to be long before all the 18,000 separate county and city police agencies in this country are unified under a central command, whether it's under the new National Intelligence Director, McConnell, or... whether it's under the Department of Homeland Security or whether they create a brand new national police force and just call it that. I think we are headed towards absolute despotism. It was funny, that first interview I said, there's serious constitutional questions for me. You got all the different 18,000 different police departments around this country, all dependent for their money and their authority, dependent on the national government. That's a big problem. That's a constitutional problem. And the guest said, huh? I disagree with you. There's any kind of constitutional question about it. Simply a policy question. Really? I mean, I don't want to fight with them about it because what the hell? People read the Constitution like it's the damn Bible. They get whatever they want out of it now. But I'm sorry. I don't see anything in there that says that the national government shall have the power to create, sustain, and or control local police authorities within the states. I don't see anything even implying that. I mean, I guess in a sense, if you take, the 14th Amendment, they have the power to intervene to protect the rights of individuals from their states, from their state governments, if the state governments are persecuting them, etc. At least, I don't know, I'd have to get Anthony Gregory or somebody on to explain the 14th Amendment in its proper context. But it's not unconstitutional to have the local police department on federal welfare. I don't remember the Constitution being amended. Do you guys? Do you guys even know that there's a thing in the Constitution? I think it's Article 7, Article 6 or 7, I forget. There's a process for amending the Constitution if you want to change it, right? Rather than just ignoring it and pretending it doesn't say anything. You can do that. It's just a matter of getting two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-fourths of the states to agree. Or in fact, you could even have the states call for a constitutional convention. Let's hope that never happens, because our Bill of Rights will be in the trash. Article 1, 2, and 3, all restrictions will be removed, and we will have an absolute fascist state in this country. Anybody calling for a constitutional amendment, whether their heart's in the right place or not, beware. I mean, not an amendment, a convention. Is that what I said? I forget. Amend it? Fine. No conventions. I don't even like this Constitution. I'm with, what's his name? The Butler Schaefer quoted, "It's all sail and no anchor." I'm with Lysander Spooner. "It's either created such a government as we have had or has been unable to prevent it. In either case, it is unfit to exist." I'm with Patrick Henry. "I smell a rat," Patrick Henry said. But, I don't want it replaced with a worse one. You know, the U.S. Constitution ain't perfect. It ain't anarcho-capitalism. It's a hell of a lot better than what we have now. And the idea that it just creates some central government that can do whatever it wants, why, if that was what the Constitution said, it would have never been ratified. It would have been just some words on a piece of paper that never meant anything to anyone. It was ratified because they explicitly explained that that was not what they were creating, a national government. They were creating a federal one. You know, read the Federalist Papers and read the Republican Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers. See what the people opposed to the Constitution were saying. And see what the people arguing for the Constitution were saying to reassure those dissenters. Everything's going to be fine. It's not like we're going to have a massive permanent standing army in a permanent state of presidential war and unlimited authority collected every day under his auspices. Again, it's in the paper today. Not only have the Democrats now legalized spying on everyone without any judicial check whatsoever, the Bush administration wasted no time at all in issuing a proclamation of some sort, instructing the courts that they have to dismiss all lawsuits about the wiretapping because Congress has said it's legal, so it's legal, and all lawsuits are cannot be heard because of the state secrets privilege. That's right, it would tell the terrorists what we're up to if we let there be a judicial check. And I'll bet you dollars to dimes right now they'll get away with that one too. Why not? Again, who's there to stop them? Who is there to stop them? I don't know. And, man, I didn't even get to talk about all the anti-Iran propaganda and what lies it all is. Look at the anti-war blog. I debunked the Iranians behind the EFP thing there, and I'll have a bunch more for you tomorrow. This has been Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and I'll leave you with some music here. How about the Circle Jerks?
You yellow in the first, your back up against the wall. They're up there clutching their guns, man, and it makes you feel real small, too. You think that's bitchin' bad? That ain't nothing at all. So you can just say no more. Broken glass, but it is when the grip gets to your hair. Dutch man!